Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am talking about a book entitled Godforsaken Grapes, a slightly tipsy journey through the world of strange, obscure, and underappreciated wine written by Jason Wilson. I'm not going to lie. When I first saw the name of this book, I thought it was a little bit dramatic. Godforsaken grapes. Oh my stars. That seems very, very, I don't know. It seems dramatic, right? But once you get into this book, actually, around page 49, page 50, the name suddenly makes sense. So this book is about, well, sort of wines off the beaten path made from less common grape varieties. And I'll get into it in this podcast, but the title of this book was inspired by an online rant excoriating those who preach the gospel of diversified drinking, written by none other than Robert Parker. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, Study Hall, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. So let's jump into this book. So I thought the name of the author was familiar. I was like, Jason Wilson, who is that? And it turns out I did know who this guy was. I don't know that we've actually ever met, but he is an author. He's written multiple books, obviously, not just this one, but several other books. And he, for several years, I think like 6 years, actually had a drinks, like a cocktail column in the Washington Post. And that was actually at the same time as I was working and living in Washington, D.C. And so being a sommelier in Washington, D.C., part of the beverage culture, his name was just one that I encountered. So he got his start talking about cocktails and cocktail culture, writing them. And then honestly, in his own words, he kind of just felt like he was done with it. He'd run the gamut, and he started getting into wine, and he tried to pivot his career at the Post and other places from cocktails into wine. Didn't work. So he just cast a wide net. And so now he does all kinds of things. He's a wine and spirits critic for Venice. He has done some travel writing. And this is a really cool book. It's part travel book, it's part memoir, and it's part educational book. And I'm a generalist. I like all kinds of wine. And I think that the world of wine is broad and it's diverse. And life would be awfully boring to only drink a wine made from the same grape over and over and over again. That doesn't stop people from drinking wines made from the same grape over and over and over again. But as this book points out, there are nearly 1,400 grape varieties in the world that are used for wine production. It is interesting to note, there's so many fun little facts in this book. I was just underlining stuff left and right. But of those 1,300 and, I don't know, some odd, nearly 1,400 different grape varieties, 99.9% of the grapes that are used for wine production are genus and species Vitis vinifera. So this is the scientific name of the genus and species of wine grapes, of which there are many varieties that are used for wine production. And the 0.1% that is not vinifera is due to Americans. It's because we're using Norton and Catawba and all these other, you know, hybrid varieties that aren't Vitis vinifera to put in our, like, I don't know, clever, cute, regional, interesting, but maybe not super delicious wines. So I guess we're the reason that 100% of the wines produced are not from Vitis vinifera. But this book takes an interesting world tour, I guess. It's divided into three parts. The first part, and each part has multiple chapters. The first part is called Vines in the Sky, and it details mostly Alpine wines. And so when we talk about this, we're talking about like wines from, you know, high altitude locations in like Switzerland and Eastern France. And wine is produced all over the world. And one of the cool things about drinking wine is not only is it delicious and an intoxicant, but if you travel to places where wine is produced, like oftentimes they're really pretty. And so it was really kind of gorgeous to think about visiting some of these places. And he talks about the food that he eats there and how it pairs with the wine. But the first section details Alpine wines, and there's some great stories, which I'll talk about. The second part is called Travels in the Lost Empire of Wine. And this is a really interesting part. It focuses mostly on Austria and Hungary. And the reason that the wine culture, kind of the interruptions to the wine production and the wine culture in those areas, the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and world wars, and then an Austrian wine scandal in the mid-1980s. And then the third part is called Selling Obscurity. And in this section, he details a lot of Eastern European wines from countries that were, you know, behind the former Iron Curtain. One of my favorite parts about this book is that at the end of it, there is an appendix or a gazetteer of 101 obscure grape varieties, including pronunciations. Look, I try really hard, y'all. I try really hard to pronounce things correctly. And I have found that when one is an avid reader, and this is not just about wine, but you can kind of tell if somebody's a really avid reader, because sometimes you read above your grade level or your maturity level, and you come across a word that you don't know, and you just sound it out in your head. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. And so sometimes when people mispronounce words, it's because they read it and they didn't know any better. That certainly happens in wine, right? We're talking about a lot of foreign countries, names, things like that. So I do my best. I'm always learning. I'll share with you what I learn. But if I make a mistake, well, I will do better. So back to the original story about why this book has the name that it does, which I think is, it's just really, really funny. So Jason Wilson was just really getting into this idea of the fact that there's so much wine out there and there's so many different grapes. And I guess in early 2014, and I should mention this book was published in 2018, so it's not brand new, but it's pretty recent. He says, the clearest and most notorious example of Parker's prejudice towards non-noble grapes happened in early 2014, just as he, Jason Wilson, the author, had begun starting to share his discoveries of grapes like Sino Mavro or Fair Sauvageux in his wine articles that he was publishing. I was not aware of this, but apparently R.P., Robert Parker, published a now infamous, I mean, I guess it's not that infamous, I had not heard of it, unhinged rant that scolded people like me who embrace off-the-beaten-path wines. He called us, quote, Euro-elitists and wannabes and extremists whose recommendations are, wait for it, the epitome of cyber group goose-stepping and Kim Jong-unism. Yes, he did. He was the literary equivalent of an old man shaking his fist at younger punks saying, get off my lawn. There's more. The rant was entitled, There is No Reason and the Truth is Plain to See. It's taken from lyrics of a song, but he basically goes on, Robert Parker, to refer to that in his 35 years as a wine critic, he's just has absolutely no use for these neo-intellectuals full of, you know, perpetrating their propaganda machines. And like, it gets really kind of crazy what he's talking about. But mostly what he seems to focus his ire at is the number of younger wine writers and sommeliers who don't share his opinions. So just a little flashback. Robert Parker is certainly one of the world's most influential and famous wine critics, and he really rose to fame when he predicted the greatness of the 1982 vintage in Bordeaux. And he certainly developed a style of wines upon which he bestowed, you know, high point values on a 100-point scale, so 100-point wines. And there is a phenomenon that's fairly well known called Parkerization, where wine growers realize that there was great importance in receiving high scores from Robert Parker. And so they modified their winemaking styles to create wines that were more in line with his personal tastes. And those tastes tended to be for big, powerful, extracted, lavishly oaked, high alcohol wines, oftentimes red, but not always. And wine is trendy. It's always going to change. Preferences, palates, it's all going to evolve over time, to be sure. And not everybody gets down with that kind of wine. And the author says, some of us were fed up with high alcohol over oak jammy fruit proms. Now, let's be clear. Not everything that Parker loves was a high alcohol over oak jammy fruit prom. If you want to talk in extremes, sure, a lot of them were, but not everything was. But I guess having an opinion, you know, that went contrary to Robert Parker just really got under his skin, which is pretty funny because as an influential wine critic with over 35 years in the business, one would think that he would maybe be confident enough not to be bothered by the opinion of some young upstart writers and sommeliers. But I guess that wasn't the case. And he writes, Robert Parker, in his unhinged rant, look at me picking a fight with Robert Parker. Who am I? What am I doing? I'm not picking the fight. I'm just quoting. He says, what we also have from this group of absolutists, which is ironic, is a near complete rejection of some of the finest grapes and the wines they produce. Instead, they espouse with enormous gusto and noise, also ironic, grapes and wines that are virtually unknown. That's their number one criteria, not how good it is, but how obscure it is. Of course, they would have you believe some godforsaken grapes that in hundreds of years of viticulture, wine consumption, etc., have never gotten traction because they are rarely of interest. And then he goes on to list a laundry list of these godforsaken grapes. Things like Trousseau and Sauvignon, Negrette, Pellorsan, Aubin, Calais. I mean, there's stuff that I've never heard of, to be sure, that these grapes can produce wines. He says, in truth, rarely palatable wines lost in a larger blend that consumers should be beating a path to buy and drink. That's savage, right? Look, there's room for all of us at this, you know, in the big wine cellar of the world. And it is just really funny that Robert Parker was getting, you know, all flustered about people he felt to be absolutists. And also that he seemed to think these folks were beating the drum for wines made from grapes where obscurity was the only criteria, not how good the wine was, but how obscure it is. And I'm going to go ahead and put a spoiler alert out there. This author doesn't do that. It's actually one of the things I liked most about this book is in his travels and his tastings, every now and then he comes across a wine that he doesn't like. And he found himself, oh gosh, where was he? I think he was either in Eastern France or he was in Switzerland. He was somewhere Alpine. I can't quite remember, but he was tasting all these interesting wines and he sent a picture of the bottles to his father. And his father, he says, fancies himself a fine wine aficionado. And his father texted back, well, are the wines any good? And Jason writes, I put my phone away. As fathers so often unwittingly do, he turned up the volume on doubts that I'd begun to whisper inside my head. All the wine I had tasted on this journey had certainly been interesting. Many of the wines had been very good, some amazing, but not all of them. And each time I tasted a rescued indigenous grape that I didn't enjoy, I felt guilty, as if my negative judgment might banish this grape forever. I mean, that's a lot of import that he's putting on himself. But as if I were Noah turning away some small mammal from the ark because it was weird and smelled like bong resin. And that would refer mostly to the wines, because there are definitely some really crazy wines that he describes. I should also say, I really like the way this guy describes wines. And I've talked about it before in some podcast. I can't remember which. But the topic of tasting notes is kind of a polarizing one in the world of wine. And what I mean by tasting note is, you know, you taste a wine, and whether you're professional or you're doing it for personal reasons, you try to describe the wine, what it smells like, what it looks like, what it tastes like. And look, a lot of publications take a lot of poetic license and they sound downright stupid. Tasting notes, they sound really poetic. And some of Jason Wilson's tasting notes sound poetic also, but additionally, I should say, they're so descriptive that it helps me understand these wines. Like, I can picture these wines that I've never tasted because of the way he describes them. I want to find an example for you, friends. Some of the examples of tasting notes that he includes are things like a wine that tasted like eating fresh cherries while smoking a clove cigarette and burning leaves in the backyard. And those are all three. Well, I don't really burn leaves in my backyard because I live in the city. That seems like a poor choice for me. But I know exactly what clove cigarettes smell like, and I can picture eating cherries. And that might seem super poetic to you all, but it really resonates with me. Or he talks about a category of wines that are well known as orange wines, which are a lot of them in this book are featured that way. It's an orange wine is made from white grapes, where you ferment the juice in contact with the grape skins. And most white grapes have kind of greenish yellow skins, and most white wine is kind of greenish yellow. And so skins are not necessary to make white wine. And so for, I don't know what percentage, but like 99.9% of all white wines, wines made from white grapes, you just crush the grapes and then you remove the skins from the juice and you just let it ferment. But historically, like when I say historically, ancient times, a lot of producers would just let it all mesh up together. And when you do let white grapes, the juice macerate with the broken skins, what happens is you end up getting a wine that is structured like a red wine. You get components structurally from the skins, like tannins, and you do get a little color. It's kind of an orangey color, but they can really run the rainbow from kind of a pink to more of an amber. And I will say a lot of the producers in this book specifically corrected the author, wanting their wines to be described as amber as opposed to orange, which I thought was interesting. And one of the objections is they didn't want consumers to misunderstand and think that it was wine made from oranges. I recently learned that in fact, in Florida, there is orange wine, not hipster like Slovenian orange wine, but wine made from oranges. If any of you all have had this, I want to hear about it because I never have and I'm very curious to try. So this idea of amber wines, and he was tasting some, and how did he describe it? He was sitting, I think, at a restaurant with one of with a vine ampelographer that he got to know, and they were talking about stuff, and they were ordering kind of off the beaten path bottles of wine, and they ordered one together, and neither one of them really liked it, and they didn't want to kind of, not that they didn't want to fess up that they didn't like it, but I think they were a little bit disappointed, and I think he describes it as like tasting like a flower pot in which like cigarette butts had like been stomped in, like put out. And you're like, oh yeah, like kind of dead flowers and dirt and like that like old cigarette smell. Like that sounds gross. I wouldn't want to drink a wine that tasted like that. And he talks about the structure in an orange wine or an amber wine where it has tannins as like licking a terracotta pot. And I feel like I want to go do that because tannins, it's a compound that exists in the stems and the skins and the seeds of grapes. You don't use the seeds. You can use the stems, but if you're making red wine, you definitely use the skins. And tannin has a feeling. It is both a tactile sensation and it also has a flavor. It can be a little bit bitter. And so it has the effect of drying out your mouth. I think that's a very apt description that I haven't really heard before. Like, you know, a clean one, not the inside of a terracotta pot in which you've planted, but maybe the outside, just you know, you guys, I'm going to try it and see. This is not the same thing as licking rocks or anything like that, but just that drying kind of astringent sensation. I thought that was a good description. So his descriptions are really great. One thing that's neat about this book is that he's not just focusing on super obscure, never had heard of grapes. He tackles things like Grüner Veltliner or sweet styles of Riesling from Germany. And that might seem really mainstream. I mean, if you're listening to a podcast about wine books, I'm going to go ahead and take for granted that you're into wine. And look, I love wine. I'm fairly knowledgeable about wine. And I was a little surprised at first. But what makes those apt inclusions in this book is he goes into the history of them and why maybe certain styles have not been long popular or why they've fallen out of favor. And that will also make them obscure. I mean, Riesling is one of the most planted grape varieties in the world, but there is great preference for drier styles. There's a great deal of prejudice for sweeter styles. I myself like both, but I thought that that was really interesting. So it's not just all wines that you've never heard of and grapes that you cannot pronounce, even without the gazetteer at the end of this. There's stuff that you've heard of, but the history behind it is where it gets really, really interesting. This book captured my interest from the jump. And I haven't spent a ton of time studying Alpine grapes or tasting wines from Switzerland. And if you have not either, there's a really good reason for that. So Switzerland produces a decent amount of wine. It's certainly nowhere close to its neighbors, you know, Germany and Austria and Italy and France. But most of Swiss wine is actually consumed domestically in Switzerland. Very little is exported. And what is pretty expensive. And what is exported is made from these less well-known Alpine grapes. So there's like four reasons why you probably aren't terribly familiar with Swiss wine. In the very first chapter entitled Dangerous Grapes, the author is describing how he is in the Swiss canton, or it's like kind of one of the states of Switzerland called the Valais. And he is enjoying a local specialty called raclette. And if you've never had the pleasure, if you enjoy cheese, then you really need to find some raclette. And as someone who used to live in the mountains of Colorado or just really enjoys cheese, this is something I've enjoyed before. But the cheese itself is this very large wheel. And classically how it's served is you heat up the cut surface of the cheese with an iron. There's modern and traditional methods of doing this. And once it gets really bubbly and gooey and melting, a person with a long knife called a racleur scrapes this cheese off of the surface of the giant heavy wheel and onto a plate of like boiled potatoes. And then the traditional accompaniments are things like pickles, like cornichons and some onions and mushrooms and bread. And it's really, really delicious. And he's talking about just eating this raclette and just enjoying all these different cheeses and all the cheese and all the accoutrement. And he asked for a glass of water. And as soon as I read that, I was like, oh no, you don't do that. And then he details why you don't do that. The waiter gently scolds him and says, never drink cold water with raclette. The cheese will congeal into a cheese baby in your stomach. And that's true. You shouldn't drink if you didn't know. And I would say that this also applies to fondue, which is another style of Alpine melted cheese cuisine, to the point where, funny little story, I love inserting my own anecdotes, but a couple years ago, I was in Champagne for a work trip and I went in a little early. I went in a weekend before our trip was to commence because, I mean, I wanted to spend some extra time in Champagne. And in the city of Reims, I went in with a colleague of mine, a friend of mine. So we were just, you know, taking some visits and some tours. And we found in the city of Reims, a little restaurant called Savoir Faire, I should say. Let me be specific about that pronunciation. And the Savoir is an area in like southeastern France near a maybe slightly more well-known area called the Jura. And they make, it's an, kind of an Alpine region, and they make their Alpine wines and they have cheeses there. So there's this little cute restaurant called Savoir Faire. So, you know, the cuisine of this region. And it was like a little Alpine ski hut. It looked like an on-mountain restaurant. There were like skis on the ceiling and you ordered fondue. And my friend and colleague was going to ask for a glass of water. And I was like, no, Angie, you can't have water. And she was like, what? I'm thirsty. And I was like, you just got to drink wine. I was like, cold water and melty cheese. I didn't know the term or use the term cheese baby, but I will from here on out. So there you go. I just love that that's a thing that, you know, I was aware of, but also the author was aware of. So now you guys know, that's a PSA. If you are eating melty cheese, any kind of melty cheese, just be sure you're drinking wine with it and not chilled water. I think some of my favorite stories in this whole book, probably like in terms of funny, detail in the first section, the vines in the sky, the Alpine section. And there's another little story, and this is some stuff I've never heard of. So the author is in Switzerland and in a little restaurant and talking about how, you know, just drinking the local wine and how you just drink it all day long. And at noon, you might switch from white to red. And he was in Zurich and he was eating, and I won't even pronounce it because it's And the author details actually his feeling why one of the reasons certain wines are less popular is because we're afraid of umlauts. And there's like three umlauts in this word, and I'm not afraid of them, but I can't pronounce it. But the meal he was enjoying was sliced veal strips in a mushroom cream sauce, served with a side of rosti, which are like, it's like Swiss German hash browns. Rosti potatoes are super delicious. Anyway, his dining companion suggested two different red wines, one called Cornelin and one called Cornelin de Valais. And he says, reaching the zenith of wine naming insanity, his dining companion Boris explained that these two Cornelin wines were actually made from completely different grapes. Super helpful, right? So they're tasting these wines made from these red grapes. They're just sitting in this restaurant in Zurich. And he notices there's a table of how he describes them, sporty young men from, you know, a neighbor table. And one guy in particular was encouraged by his friends. And they're in a picture, if you will, you know, listener, just a classic Swiss chalet style restaurant, maybe with high beams and, you know, kind of taverny. And one of these guys at a neighboring table jumps up, stands on his table and grabs onto the huge ceiling beam above him and tries to pull himself up. And at first the author, Jason, is like, what in the world? And then he realizes on the menu of the restaurant, he actually sees an illustration of what's happening. And it's a tradition called Balkenprobe. I'm not exactly sure how to say it, but it's a challenge to, quote, take the beam. So challengers in this restaurant, it's either a thing that happens in Zurich or a thing that happens just in this restaurant, maybe when you're drinking plenty of Cornelin, but this is a wine-related tradition. Challengers must climb over one ceiling beam headfirst and then crawl over a second beam and then hang by their legs upside down where they are then given a glass of wine to drink. So the young man struggles, he pulls himself up through the beam, and everyone in the tavern starts knocking their fists on the table to encourage him. The author's dining companion, Boris, stood below the young man as a spotter, and he said, it's all about the technique. Finally, the young man pulls himself across the second beam, he hangs down, and Boris pours him a glass of wine, which he finished in a few gulps. He swung down to the ground and then just returned to his cheering friends at their table, and like life went on. So like in terms of a travel book and just like wine adventures and traditions, yes, that's a tradition that involves drinking wine, obviously Swiss wine. I'm here for that. I'm not sure that any proprietor of any restaurant would be here for that, domestically maybe, but I thought it was absolutely hilarious. One of the more sobering statistics in this book are when the author talks about certain grape varieties and just how little of them there are left. And if nothing else in this book, that alone, I think, encourages me to want to seek out some of these wines and try them. And he also details all of the reasons, or some of the reasons, why there are so few of these wines left. He talks about a producer that he visited in Switzerland. And in 2014, they were drinking wines made from a grape called Verdesse. Less than a dozen acres of Verdesse exist. It tasted like snow from a mountain meadow that had been collected and melted in a hollow melon. That's a great descriptor. I love it and I'm here for it. But oh my gosh, that's so precarious. Less than a dozen acres of this one particular grape, which sounds delicious, are left. And I don't want to spoil it, but you know, this producer that he was talking about, to actually get to their high alpine vineyards, they had to take like a gondola ride, but not like the high speed, like fancy gondolas that you might take, you know, if you were skiing or, you know, something like that. It's like some rickety contraption with like made of wood and you know, people die on with frequency. And as we find out through this book, it's spoiler alert, but this winemaker who was kind of old and tending these impossible to get to high altitude vineyards with these obscure grape varieties, the author finds out he died, not because of an issue with the gondola. I think it was a tractor accident. And his first thought was, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to his, you know, his vineyards? How sad. And, you know, he had the winemaker had a wife, but they were both quite elderly. And I guess neighboring wine growers were all pitching in at least for that next vintage. But after that, who knows? And so it is kind of sad because some of these wines sound so interesting and so delicious. Some of them sound horrible, but it makes me want to try some things out. I will say one of the most alluring things about these wines is because they are not that well known, these grapes, oftentimes, at least domestically, they are very, very affordable. And when you find something that's super delicious and it doesn't cost a whole lot of money, there's a great amount of value. And that's one thing that I think is really important in the world of wine to consider is value. Now, value, it's not attached to a specific price point. You can have a wine that costs you $300 and it can be a great value. And the author talks about that in his chapter on vintage port, which might not seem like an obscure wine, but he details why there is some obscurity and how the folks in, you know, creating the port producers have saved and kind of consistently propagated and used these indigenous varieties to make port. But even amongst all the different styles of port, its popularity has been waning in recent years. And so something that, you know, we think of as ubiquitous is actually maybe a little bit more precarious than we might think. But a $300 bottle of vintage port is expensive, yes. But considering the high quality and the scarcity of a very nice bottle of vintage port compared to, say, a very nice vintage dated bottle of Bordeaux or Burgundy, it's actually a really good value. And value comes up in a very unlikely place in this book. And the author spends some time in Italy, all over Italy, and talks about some wine grapes that I'm quite familiar with, like Prosecco or Sagrantino, De Montefalco in Umbria. And there's hundreds of grape varieties in Italy. I'm certain that many people who are into wine are familiar with many of them. And if we were going to make some broad sweeping generalizations and ask any person on the street, if we were going to do like a every person interview and just go out on the street with a camera and a microphone and ask someone if they could think of an Italian wine and a white one, what would be the first thing they think of? And I'd be willing to bet that many people would think of Pinot Grigio. And I'm not here to knock Pinot Grigio. There are really great examples. And the author talks about really great examples of Pinot Grigio. But what was so interesting to me is when he details essentially what's this idea of how Pinot Grigio came to be so ubiquitous and perhaps usurped so many other delicious Italian white wines. And so it's pretty interesting. And he talks about this, and I've said this before myself. Pinot Grigio's path to popularity, he says, is mind-boggling. And I love, there's a lot of statistics in this book, but it helps justify his argument, which I think is really important. This blows my mind. Between 2000 and 2010, the amount of Pinot Grigio planted in Italy increased by more than 60% to 42,000 acres, roughly mirroring the explosive growth of Prosecco. Often neutral, bland, and lemonade-like, Pinot Grigio is, there's some snark here, the wine of choice for summer beach drinking and cougars on the prowl. I'm not going to even get into that, but people really guzzle down Pinot Grigio. And the author does ask, I guess supposes, that perhaps Pinot Grigio represents the Subway Tuscan chicken sub of wine. But he says that he feels, and I agree with this point, that it's consistently the biggest ripoff in the wine shop. He says, and he teaches classes in a wine shop, and he's worked with restaurants and certainly many different aspects of the industry. And he says, I regularly see people who complain about spending more than $10 for a bottle of wine walk into a store and drop $23.99 on a bottle of Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio. This is true. I point this out to people all the time. It's not inexpensive, right? There are some inexpensive Pinot Grigios. And I will also say that some of the best, most characterful, most varietally typical Pinot Grigios out there are less than $23.99. But people go bananas for Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio. For years, it was the top-selling wine over $20 in the United States, with more than $25 million in annual sales at the height of its consumption. Here's where the interesting facts to back this all up kind of come in. And this is a little bit of a legend. I'm not sure if this is entirely fact, but apparently there was a well-known wine producer named Tony Terlato, and he imported wine to the United States. And the story goes that he had an epiphany one night over a glass of Pinot Grigio. This is in 1979. And he wrote in his memoir that he felt that other well-known Italian white wines of that period that you could find in the United States, like Orvieto or Frascati or Suave or Verdicchio, would never sell for more than $5 a bottle. This is 1979 prices. Terlato wrote in his 2008 memoir, he returned to Italy to find, I love this, a white varietal, sick, that could command a higher price in the high-end restaurants. I'm going to go ahead and say it right now. Jason Wilson never misuses variety and for varietal. And to the point that when he's quoting someone who does, he puts in that little SIC, that sick, like, this is how it was written. It's not my error. It's that guy's error. Love it. I appreciate that so much. So anyway, apparently, as the story goes, Tony Terlato goes to Milan and he sits down. He was served a Pinot Grigio. His life changed. The next day, he drove to a town close to where that one particular wine was produced. And at dinner that night in the hotel, he ordered every Pinot Grigio on the restaurant's wine list. There were 18 of them. After tasting all 18 Pinot Grigios with the owner of the restaurant, they agreed that the Santa Margherita, this is in 1979, was the best. The next day, he drove to Alto Adige to the producer, the owner, to the palazzo of the owner of Santa Margherita, and he made the owner an offer to have a 10-year agreement to import the wines. They signed the deal, and Tony Terlato was able to introduce a practically unknown varietal, sick, to the American market, considerably above the price of any other available Italian white wine. And who's to say if it was luck or if he had a little bit of, you know, clairvoyance, but the rest is history. Santa Margherita split from Terlato in 2015, but they had 36 years in business, made Terlato a boatload of money. And now there are entire shelves in wine stores devoted to Pinot Grigio. And so the author goes on later in the book to muse that what if it had been another wine? What if he had been poured something else that rocked his ever-loving world? Like, would Pinot Grigio have become what it's become in the United States? And would maybe one of these other less well-known grape varieties have taken off? I mean, maybe there's so much more than what Robert Parker wants to believe. Like, there's other forces that control what happens. To that point, that the author talks about, he takes a journey through southwestern France and all of the interesting wines. This is one part of France I've never been to, but, you know, interesting wines made, you know, kind of rustic and wild and fun and sparkling and tannic and red, all these different wines made from all these different grapes. And if you think about the map of France, Bordeaux is actually fairly southwest in France. I know we always think of it just being on the Atlantic coast, but the Loire is very centrally located north to south. Bordeaux is south of the Loire on the Atlantic coast. So if you're looking at the map of France, it's kind of southwest. And then the sudwest, the actual southwest part of France, is below and slightly west of that. And the author details one of the reasons he thinks that perhaps these wines were not, they never achieved necessarily the success of their northern neighbors. He asks, perhaps powerful people have always wanted it that way. So here's a little history lesson. Something new, we love to learn. Back in the 13th and 14th centuries, the merchants in Bordeaux began to see the wines of southwest France as a threat to their economic interests. Look, wine is delicious, it tastes good, but fundamentally, people aren't just making wine for their own consumption, they are selling it. It is both an agricultural product and it is a commercially traded thing. So Bordeaux, wanting to keep its dominance over the wine trade with England, their major trading partner, flexed its muscles to establish a strict code called the Police des Vins. The wine police, you guys. They created a wine police, which decreed that no wine could be traded out of Bordeaux, which was the major shipping port on the Atlantic coast of France. No wine could be traded out of Bordeaux until the majority of Bordelais wine had already been sold. This dealt a devastating blow to the winemakers in southwest France. So yes, they're also on the Atlantic coast and just south of Bordeaux, but to get their wines anywhere, they would need to be shipped out of the major ports of Bordeaux. And the Police des Vins, basically this code decreed that first we have to sell all the Bordelais wines, and then once those are sold, then you can sell your wine. So it was a huge market detriment to selling all of these wines. I had no idea. I mean, there's a lot of historical kind of interesting things to learn about the wine trade in Bordeaux, some good, many bad, but they basically shut down the Southwest. There's other reasons for perhaps why we haven't seen more interesting wines become more mainstream. And there's too much to detail in this podcast, but one of the things that I think is so interesting is all of the time that the author spends in Austria, and he talks about Grüner Veltliner, which I think is pretty mainstream, but he talks about sort of its rise from obscurity to kind of the peak, and maybe it's fallen off a little bit. I drank a bottle yesterday, you know, like I think Grüner Veltliner is fantastic. It hasn't fallen off anywhere for me, but I mean, I had help. I didn't just, just polish off a bottle of Grüner Veltliner myself. But he talks about sort of how some of these wines were at absolute global heights, and they were, you know, they were the wines of royalty, or they were the wines to be served at weddings or whatever for all of, you know, part of the Habsburg dynasty or the Austro-Hungarian dynasty. These wines were at their peak. And then when that fell and subsequent world wars, and then when, particularly in World War II, the author details how when Nazi Germany took over Austria, a lot of these grape varieties were just lost. Specifically, you don't tend to see, and he talks about this, you don't see a lot of wines from Austria that predate the 1950s. It might be about as old a wine as you ever have. He tasted one with Willy Brundlemeier. And a lot of these older prize wines were lost when the famous enology school in Austria, Kloster Neuburg, it was bombed in 1945 in World War II. And then the decade following the war was obviously super chaotic. Austria was occupied by the United States, then the UK, then France, and the Soviet Union. And the wine regions, really famous wine regions of Comtal and Kremstal, were part of the zone governed by the Soviet Union. And he had been told, the author was told by several winemakers, and this goes back to a lot of what we covered in Wine and War, that Soviet troops, you know, who were in charge of, you know, kind of overseeing and governing this part of Austria, drank a lot of the best wines during the 40s and 50s. They don't have a lot of older bottles because the troops drank them. So old varieties and, you know, heirloom grapevines were destroyed when the wine school, the enology school, was bombed. But then a lot of the old stocks were just depleted by occupying troops. There's also some interesting information about one of Austria's great red grapes. We think in Austria mostly about white wines, about Grüner Veltliner and Riesling, but depending on where you are in the country, they make some pretty fantastic red wines as well. And Blaufränkisch and Zweigelt are probably the two most well-known. They're not the only wines that are known, but the author details a history of the creation of Zweigelt and the very unsavory facts surrounding the person who created it. Zweigelt takes its name from an Austrian scientist who developed this crossing in a lab. And the wine, the grape, is also known by the name Rotberger. And when Dr. Zweigelt died in 1979, the name was officially changed of this grape from Rotberger to Zweigelt. Now, there's so many reasons why it might be difficult to have a wine be more mainstream. And the United States is a very large consuming population. And the author supposes that Rotberger is not the kind of name that there'd just be associations maybe that you don't want to call for a glass of Rotberger. Maybe that doesn't sound really appealing to most folks. But as he did a little digging, he found himself in a tavern in Austria, and he was drinking a glass of Zweigelt, and there was another guy at the bar, and he asked, what are you drinking? And the author said Zweigelt, and they had a little conversation. He said, oh, so you're drinking the Nazi wine? The author was pretty shocked, and so he got back to his Airbnb, and he found an article in that day's paper and translated it. And the article was entitled, Some Wines Leave a Bitter Taste, that the local wine critic for the newspaper had been writing. And the author of this article was railing against the fact that the Zweigelt grape in 2015 was still inexplicably named after its inventor. So Dr. Zweigelt, besides inventing several grape hybrids, according to the article, was also a butterfly collector, a moderately talented amateur poet, but more significantly, he was also a committed Nazi, joining the party as early as 1933, when that was still forbidden in Austria. After Hitler annexed Austria in 1938, Dr. Zweigelt was promptly promoted to head the Klosterneuburg Enology School, where he served until the end of World War II. Besides the usual harassment of Jews, he also delivered a student with connections to the resistance movement to the Gestapo. You just hate to hear this kind of stuff, right? And the author was like, what do we do with this? He didn't know what to take about it. And this is the thing with wine, right? Is that one of the things that's interesting about wine is that it combines so many things, science and history and war. And there are people who have made significant contributions to all aspects of life who also were deplorable human beings. And in this case, he wasn't a soldier, but God, he turned over a student to the secret police. Like that's a death sentence, right? And that's horrible. There's absolutely no equivalation there. And so we started thinking, like, what's the alternative? What do you do? Is this as disastrous a scandal as the 1985 scandal where producers in Austria were found to be adulterating wine with diethylene glycol to make it sweeter and richer? That did have the positive effect, by the way. While no one was sickened or died, it did have the positive effect of Austria enacting some of the strictest quality controls. And so now you are reasonably assured to, have some of the, strictest quality controls. So no adulteration or kind of like cutting corners for wine production. But what do you do about this? And so the author understands, why they changed the name of the grape after the person who made the crossing in the Enology School. But what do you do then? Do you start calling it back by its original name, Rotberger? And so he does what I think anyone does. He starts talking to Austrian winemakers. And I think he doesn't have the answer to this. And this is not a podcast saying you shouldn't drink Zweigelt and you shouldn't drink Austrian wine. I've tasted Zweigelt. It's super delicious. But he talks to one of the most respected and most famous winemakers in Austria, Comtal winemaker Willy Brundlmeier. And he was asking about it. And he's like, I don't know what to do. He's like, it's 70 years ago. Somebody's putting something out in the newspaper. Maybe it's, he's like, I don't know what'll happen. Maybe we have to change the name. Nobody knows exactly the answer. And you can't erase the history. It's there. It's important to understand the history so we don't ever make those mistakes again. But it is also important to know that the people who are producing Zweigelt today, that's not an association necessarily. It's just this grape got crossed in a lab by, by an enologist who also happened to be a pretty horrible human being. So there's so much history in this book, and I learned so many interesting facts. This podcast can barely scratch the surface on all the information that's contained within here. And I didn't really so much get into the memoir aspects, but there are some personal stories about like his childhood, and his family took a summer one year to travel through Portugal. And he weaves those stories into his visits as an adult and a wine writer to Portugal. And so it can hop around a little bit. Sometimes I had to double check like where I was in the story because I felt like maybe I'd zoned out or wasn't paying attention. But by and large, super, super interesting. So what works for this book? I mean, just about everything. I will say this. I didn't understand from the cover exactly what I was looking at. I have a paperback copy of this book. It's like 5x7. And it looks like the title's just written with a Sharpie marker. And there's a picture of a glass and like a stemmed wine glass holding red wine. And instead of just a glass stem, it looks like a USB cord. I was like, I don't understand what's going on. I think it's just a curvy line because it's the slightly tipsy journey through the world of strange wine. I think that's what that represents. But I was like, is he plugging? The cover's a little bit weird. The cover art is odd. But there's so much factual information. There's great historical information. And despite what Robert Parker might have said, I don't think this book is preachy. He's just encouraging people to seek out and try stuff. And one in particular, there was an analogy that I think makes so much sense because I'm a generalist and I like all kinds of wine. I think the wine world is big enough for all of us. But I opened a bottle of sparkling wine yesterday and it was kind of an unknown, small, kind of natty producer and I didn't like it. You should always keep trying new kinds of wine because you just never know what's going to, you know, rock your world and what you're going to think is going to be super delicious. And so I am a big proponent for trying new things and mixing it up. I really think I'm going to make more of an effort to do this in my own life right now, because I think that even I, as a generalist, I think even I can get in a little bit of a rut. And I think the problem is there's great wines that I know and I love, and I just want to drink more of them because I know them and I love them. And it is a risk. It is a gamble when you're willing to trade your money for a wine that you don't know anything about. You're betting that you'll like it. And it's maybe a little bit riskier. You might not like it. It might taste like a flower pot of dead flowers with cigarette butts put out in them. That's bad. We don't want that. We want delicious things that are fresh and tasty and lip smacking. But there's an analogy that I think is really good. And the author lives, I think he still lives in Pennsylvania. And he talks about a couple of wine bars with really kind of cutting edge and esoteric programs. And, you know, talking to the sommeliers and the owners of those wine bars, like, is this really like, is this a profitable business model? Like you're really preaching for these unusual wines, like, do guests get it? You know, are you actually expecting that this is going to be, you know, something successful? And one of the owners of one of the wine bars says that he doesn't expect Gelber Muscateller or Collarche or Chocoli to usurp the old standbys. And I think this is so prescient. He says these wines are not here to replace the usual suspects. They're here to complement them. There's room for a nice strip steak and there's room for beef tongue. And I think that that is super true. When I read that, I underlined it and I was like, yep. This is not saying that you shouldn't drink Bordeaux or you shouldn't drink Burgundy or shouldn't drink champagne, but why not mix it up a little bit and try some other things? So I think that there is a lot of wisdom in this book. Also, it's really funny. This is a pretty recent book and it covers a lot of pop culture things. I mean, funny little anecdotes about, I know if you're a listener of this podcast, you're familiar with The Judgment of Paris. Just talked about it in a podcast this year, but apparently the author grew up in New Jersey and that model of blind wine competition has been replicated over and over. It was even replicated with wines produced in the great state of New Jersey. They called it the Judgment of Princeton. But he talks about everything from the Somme movie to the Judgment of Princeton to Jay-Z and Beyonce going to Piemonte to buy Barolo and truffles. He talks about unicorn wine. Like, he talks about all this stuff. There's a lot of really interesting and current discussions and so much to learn in this book. So in terms of what doesn't work, not much. I guess the cover art was a little bit weird, but I enjoyed this book so thoroughly. I think for my rating, I feel very confident in this. I think this is a buy. If you like wine, then this will not only teach you wine, but it's a fun travel story. There's great information in this book. There's wine history. There's interesting and clever and descriptive tasting notes. I didn't know what to expect and I was so delighted. And I would hope that the same would be true for wines made from some of these unknown and obscure grapes. That's my hope for them and my feelings on this book. So I hope you'll feel the same. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. And if you like what you heard, please be sure to subscribe. Tell us what you think. Leave us a rating and talk to you next week. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somme TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somme TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.